Well, it's really nice to see everybody here today. As I mentioned last Sunday morning, I want to talk about kind of a made-up word, affluenza. I'm not going to take credit for it, by the way. It was actually a term that was made popular in the 90s by a psychologist. And even he admitted when he came up with the term that it was intentionally ironic. Now, this term has actually become a little bit in the limelight lately because of a recent event in Texas. There's a teen from an affluent family in North Texas who stole two cases of beer from a grocery store with his friends, got wildly drunk, three times over the legal limit, and drove his Ford F-350 pickup truck into a group of pedestrians. He was driving 70 miles per hour when he struck the victims, resulting in four deaths. This 16-year-old young man escaped a maximum prison sentence of 20 years by arguing through his defense attorney that his actions were the result of his upbringing in a wealthy yet dysfunctional family. His defense team used the word affluenza to say that he was not responsible for his actions. And again, this was a term that was made popular a couple decades ago. It has never been accepted in the psychological community as an actual mental disorder, though. It's always been regarded as something tongue-in-cheek by most psychologists. The young man in the case, instead of 20 years prison, is going to get 10 years probation and an opportunity to go to Southern California to participate in a rehabilitation program that his rich parents are going to have to pay $450,000 a year for. Needless to say, many are very upset at the outcome of this trial, that somebody could get wildly drunk, kill four people going 70 miles per hour in a 40-mile-per-hour zone, and essentially get away with it because he says he's not responsible for his actions. The defense claims that he had a very rich upbringing, thus he was never taught boundaries. He had a father who was psychologically and verbally abusive, and a mother who was indulgent, whose own life motto was, "If it feels good, do it." Now, I can understand at least part of the reasoning there. A 16-year-old kid put in that kind of a position with that upbringing, with everything going against him in that regard, and yet I still don't buy it. I still don't buy it. My question in all of this, though, is why are we so surprised that this is what we're finding in our culture? We're simply bearing the fruit of the rampant materialism that we've been fostering for generations now. With all of this affluence is going to come affluenza. It's only a natural result, isn't it? We're seeing marriages, we're seeing families, we're seeing integrity and personal responsibility now being thrown out the window. All of these things are being destroyed as our possessions are accumulating in piles and piles of stuff around us. Randy Alcorn explains in a book called Money, Possessions, and Eternity, affluenza is a very strange malady that affects the children of well-to-do parents. Though having everything that money can buy, the children show all the symptoms of abject poverty, depression, anxiety, loss of meaning, and despair for the future. Affluenza accounts for an escape into alcohol, drugs, shoplifting, and suicide among children of the wealthy. It is most often found where parents are absent from the house and try to buy their children's love. This is not an old story, by the way. This is not a new story. It's not a new problem. This has existed for a long time. As long as people have had the ability and opportunity to obtain wealth, they have been captivated by it to the decimation and destruction of things that are more important. After all, go to Matthew chapter 16 and see what Jesus has to say
about the accumulation of wealth to the decimation and destruction of more important things. Jesus says in Matthew chapter 16 and verse 24, "If anyone wishes to come after me, let him deny himself, take up his cross, and follow after me. For whoever wishes to save his life shall lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake shall find it." And in verse 26, "What shall it be profited a man if he gains the whole world but forfeits his soul? Or what will man give in exchange for his soul?" Although we can all recall instances in our own lives that seem somewhat comical in hindsight, I think that holidays and birthdays kind of drive this home for a lot of us. We just had Christmas a few weeks ago, or non-denominational winter gift-giving holiday, if you wish to call it that. And I have a 4-year-old son. Most of the Christmases that we've experienced up until now have been very pleasant. He's been excited by anything. You could give that kid a pair of socks. And not like in Christmas Story, you know, where they're opening socks and Randy and Ralphie look at each other and throw the socks back in unison. You could have given this kid socks when he was 1 or 2 years old, and he would have been happy about it. Put them on his hands and play around like that. Kids are happy with boxes. This is the first Christmas ever. And by the way, Sterling's a good kid. I think he's a typical kid, though, when I say this. So I'm not calling him out for anything. This is the first Christmas we've ever had, though, where he'll rip a package open and go, "Okay, next present," and toss it behind me. You're like, "I had to hunt for that." You know, you're like, your 85-year-old great-grandfather did that for you. Like, show some gratitude, young man. But you see, we laugh at that. Yeah, that's okay. It's fine to laugh at a 3 or 4-year-old kid. I mean, we don't expect a whole lot more from them than that. But it's okay to laugh at that. But don't we do the same things? Don't we go from, like, next thing to next thing to next thing in our adult lives too? We're not satisfied with anything anymore. We always have to have the next exciting thing in life. Birthdays and holidays, they're not time to give gifts. Really, for a lot of people in our society, and I think for humanity in general, they're times to get things. And we'll put on a smile and we'll say, "Thanks for the sweater, Aunt Judith." But it wasn't what we really wanted. We always want so much more. Tim Kasser writes in a book called The High Price of Materialism, "Vast numbers of us have been seduced into believing that having more wealth and material possessions is essential for a good life." And I like this idea. He says here, "We have swallowed the idea that to be well, one must first be well off. And many of us, consciously or unconsciously, have learned to evaluate our own well-being and accomplishment, not by looking inward at our spirit or our integrity, but by looking outward at what we have and what we can buy." And the fruits of materialism are all over in our culture. The growth of gambling, for example. There are over 5.5 million pathologically addicted gamblers in the United States, with the average American family frittering away over $1,000 annually. It's actually $1,174. What could you do a year with $1,174? And yet the average American family throws that away on gambling every year. And it's a growing problem, too. Divorce. It is estimated that 56% of divorces are the direct result of financial problems or disagreements over money. Infidelity. Oddly enough, the occurrence of marital infidelity actually rises statistically in conjunction with an increase in income. The more money you make, the more likely it is you're going to slip into adultery. Sleep disorders. 1/3 of all adults say financial worries significantly contribute to sleep abnormality. Pitiful charity. Of Americans who itemize their deductions, the IRS indicates that on average less than 3% of their income goes toward churches or charities. The Barna Group indicates a similar number, stating that church contributions amount to only 2.2% of income. And abortion. Yes,
Even some abortions have purely materialistic motives, since children are often seen as economic hardships or impediments to career advancement, or even as nothing more than lifestyle spoilers. Alcorn goes on to say, materialism will inevitably produce the kind of society increasingly evident in America. A society of individualism where people live parallel lives, I think that's a great term, not meaningfully intersecting with others. A society where independence is the only absolute, where self-interest is the only creed, where convenience and expediency and profitability are the only values. A society where people know the price of everything, but the value of nothing. Where people have a great deal to live on, but very little to live for. Perhaps more than anything else, materialism takes our eyes off the ultimate goal of life, which according to Matthew chapter 22 and verse 36, is to love God first and to love our neighbors as ourselves. We can blame our affluence for all kinds of things, can't we? Affluence made me do it. Money made me do it. Indulgent parents made me do it. We can blame our affluence on all kinds of things, can't we? But at the end of the day, sometimes having more is actually having less of the things that truly matter. That's what I want to do with the rest of this lesson, is consider a few things that the Bible has to say on materialism and what we need to do in our own very, very abundant lives to help correct the problem. What does Jesus say about materialism? In Luke chapter 12, notice in verse 16, in Luke chapter 12, beginning in verse 16, "And he told them a parable, saying, the land of a certain rich man was very productive." You notice Jesus never said it was a bad thing that his land was very productive. It just is what it is. If your land is very productive, it's not a bad thing. And you're not a criminal or a villain for having a productive land. You're not a criminal or a villain for having a good job. You're not a bad person, a bad parent, or a bad husband or wife because you provide for your family. That's not at all what Jesus is trying to say here. This is not a commentary on having good things in life. It's a commentary on what you do with them. "And this man began reasoning to himself in verse 17, saying, what shall I do, since I have no place to store my crops? And he said, this is what I will do. I'll tear down my barns, and I'll build larger ones. And there I will store all my grain and my goods." And again, Jesus is still not saying he's done anything wrong, though one could argue that reasoning with himself might be a problem. And in verse 19, "I will say to my soul," soul, I like that part in the book, don't you? Looks himself in the mirror and says, "Soul, you have many good things laid up for many years to come. Take your ease, eat, drink, and be merry." Isaiah 22, verse 13, right? Isaiah 22, verse 13. "But God said to him, you fool, this very night your soul is required of you. And now who will own what you have prepared? So is the man who lays up treasure for himself and is not rich toward God." We are rich toward God, according to Matthew chapter 25, by being rich toward other people. You remember in the second half of Matthew 25, where Jesus talks about in the way that you share with others, you've shared with me. You give a cup of cold water, or shelter, or food to eat, or clothing on a person's back, and you've done it to me. So when you lay up treasures toward God, it means you are laying up treasures to other people. And God becomes the recipient indirectly. But that's not all Jesus has to say. Go back to Matthew chapter 6 and notice in Matthew 6 and verse 19. Again, these are passages that are familiar to us, yet we have such a hard time living by them, don't we? In Matthew chapter 6 and verse 19, "Do not lay up for yourselves treasures upon earth, where moth and rust destroy, where thieves break in and steal. But lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where neither moth nor rust destroys, where thieves cannot break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there will your heart be also."
We talked about in 1 Peter chapter 1 this morning in Bible class, this idea of aliens in a foreign land. That's in verses 1 and 2. We talked a little bit about the way that we need to remember that this is not our home. Later on, Peter talks about the perishable versus the imperishable. This is all ideas that Peter is echoing from the ministry of Jesus. This is a perishable life. It's not meant to be permanent. You are not meant to be here forever. You're not meant to have the treasures of this world forever. This is all going to go away. Moth and rust destroy and thieves break in and steal it. And if you put your hope in this life and the things of this life, you're going to be very woefully disappointed in it. You're going to be miserable because of it. You're going to find yourself like the rich man with the giant barns facing God. The words coming out of his mouth, "You fool! You fool! You worried so much about having a good job. You fool! You worried so much about the money in your bank account. You worried so much about keeping up with the Joneses. You worried so much about the size of your television, the size of your SUV. You worried so much about the size of your house that you never put any thought into what was going to happen to you when you died. You didn't give 5 minutes notice to your soul, which is really the only thing from this life that's going to last. Moth and rust are going to destroy everything else, and thieves are going to break in and steal. But the only thing you have when you face God is what you've done in this life. Nobody can serve two masters after all. He says in Matthew 6 and verse 24, "No one can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one, love the other, or else he'll be loyal to one and despise the other." You cannot serve God and riches. And I would also add to that, I think Jesus would agree with me, you cannot serve your family and riches either. You cannot serve the church and other Christians and riches either. You cannot serve your neighbor and love him as yourself and serve riches at the same time. All of these things are connected, that you cannot be loyal to one and serve the other at the same time. You're going to love one and hate the other. That's how it has to be. It's impossible to do it otherwise. What are you really going to love then? Similar to the rich young ruler of Matthew chapter 19, we are forced by God to make a decision. Your possessions, your stuff, or eternity. Now, the saddest story in the Bible is Matthew 19, personally. I think that's the saddest story in the Bible. The man who had Jesus reach his hand out, literally, physically, and say, "You can be a personal disciple of mine and follow after me. You can go where I go, teach as I teach, see what I see." And the man went away grieved because he had too much stuff. How much stuff do you have in your life? How much stuff do you have in your garage? How much stuff do you have in your attic? What are you thinking about right now? And every year, we're so thankful at Thanksgiving for the things that we have. And the next day, we go with our families on Black Friday. We try to get a 75-inch TV for 10 bucks. Because we want more stuff. Indeed, we have a directive to work and to be productive. The materialist is instantly going to come in and say, hey, don't you accuse me of being materialistic. I'm not the rich young ruler. I'm just providing for my family. So says every workaholic in this life who didn't take a few minutes for his kids in the morning. So says every person who lets his marriage die off. The embers eventually lose their glow because he wanted a little bit more money. I agree. 1 Timothy 5 and verse 8 certainly does give us a directive to take care of our families. If a man will not take care of his own, he's worse than an unbeliever. He's an abomination if a guy is not going to take care of his own family. But materialism stretches this much, much too far. The problem with this justification is that it has a hint of self-dependence. As if taking care of your family is entirely on your shoulders. Hey, if I don't work, who's going to take care of my family? If I don't work all these hours,
Who is going to take care of my family? And there's an element of truth to that. But you have to remember that no matter how hard you work in this life, no matter how many hours you put in or how much money you have in your bank account, who is really the giver of all good things? Your family is taken care of not because you work, but because God gives all good things to be enjoyed. You have a home, not because you have a job, but because God has blessed you with a home. You have food on your table, not because you have a job, but because God has blessed you with food on your table. And I think that when we justify workaholism and materialism by saying, well, you got to work, right? That just kind of smacks of self-dependence. Like everything I have in my bank account is because of me. And my family needs to sit and grovel at my feet because of everything I've done for them to take care of them and put food on the table. And yet that is not an entirely accurate way to view your blessings. Your blessings come from God. And you can be the wealthiest, hardworking person in the world, and you might still have nothing. You remember in Ecclesiastes chapter 9, we studied recently. Wealth, he says, does not always go to the wise or the discerning. The race does not always go to the swift. The battle doesn't always go to the strong. Time and chance overtake us all. And perhaps, I'm not saying it certainly, but perhaps Solomon is saying that time and chance is a euphemism for God. A euphemism for God and His providence. Wealth doesn't always go to the discerning. And I know plenty of hard-working people who still don't have a whole lot of money. I know plenty of hard-working people who still can't manage to keep a lot in their bank accounts. You are alive because God takes care of you. You breathe because God provides the air. You drink because God gave the water. You have food because God causes the growth in all of these things. So in all of this rush to work, 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 and get more stuff, don't forget who it is that actually gives provision for each and every one of those blessings. It's God, first and foremost. I don't want to vilify something that is an object. It's very tempting when you're trying to look for blame in our society's problems to say, it's the internet's fault. It's technology's fault. It's the cell phone's fault. Cell phones, the internet, computers, and even television, they're just tools. And like all these things we've been talking about, it's how you use them that really determines what the role is and what their value is. And yet with even that caveat, I would say television needs to bear some responsibility for this. There needs to be some blame that we can, I think, fairly and squarely place on the role of TV in our lives. Don't forget, though, who's the one holding the remote? TV is destroying society, people will always say. Look at all that garbage on TV. Every time I turn the TV, it's just garbage, garbage, garbage. You didn't have to turn the TV on, did you? It's like all this smut coming into my home. Well, turn it off then. Like, did you watch the MTV Music Awards the other night? No! And what are you doing watching them? I can't believe those skimpy outfits on Dancing with the Stars. Well, what are you doing watching it then? It's like nobody forces you to turn the TV on. And maybe that's something that we really need to think about, because the television truly is the single greatest purveyor of materialistic ideas in our culture. And it's the diversity of the media that really hits us so hard. It's no longer just television. It really is an all-encompassing media attack on our lives. Advertising in particular. Advertising is a craft almost as old as time. You remember who the first advertising agent was? Satan in the garden. He's the first advertising agent. Now, is anybody in advertising? I'm not saying you're all Satan. Let's be totally clear about that. If you're in advertising, I'm not saying you're the devil. I'm saying it's a craft that Satan employs to his great benefit. From the very first conversation between the serpent and Eve, where he sold something that wasn't entirely accurate, advertising has existed since almost the beginning of time, selling things. Selling a lifestyle, selling an idea, selling an image. Did you know, Eve, that with just a single bite of the fruit from that tree, you can have the knowledge of God? You could be as smart as God. With just a single sip from this energy drink, you could be as young as we all know, physically and biologically speaking, you're incapable of being. But just one sip. It's a lie. And we're being sold all of these things. It is an art of convincing us what we need that we do not need and how to obtain it in ways that we shouldn't. It's manipulation of the oldest, basest sinful desires. Greed, envy, jealousy, covetousness. I'm selling what you don't have, but that you want. Children are particularly susceptible to this. According to psychiatrist Dr. Alan Kanner, citing several recent studies, Dr. Kanner explains that three-year-olds are capable of recognizing 100 brand logos. Sterling is four, and I was having a hard time teaching him the alphabet the other night. I was like, this is A! What letter is it? B. And yet he could recognize 100 brand logos. So it is no wonder, says one writer, that many parents have a bunch of little whiners and beggars on their hands, always demanding this new toy or that brand of new clothing. And many of these parents, totally materialistic in their own thinking, assume that they have to fulfill these demands or their children will hate them, grow up deprived, warped, and ruined. The result, however, in spite of closets bursting with unused clothing and rooms so full of toys you can't walk about, is a generation of some of the brattiest children the world has ever produced. Television distorts our perception of reality. With all the toys and the things that are around us, television advertising the lies of the sinful world chime in and say, it's still not enough for you. You need more, more, more. People with a strong materialistic orientation, says Dr. Kanner, were likely to watch a lot of television, compare themselves unfavorably with people that they saw on television, and be dissatisfied with their own standard of living. They also have low life satisfaction. Changing our habits can be very difficult, and I understand that. If you've watched television your whole life, it's hard to stop. It's hard to turn off the TV and do anything different than what you're used to. Removing ourselves from the excessive influence of the media is a good thing. And it's a good place to start if you want to change the materialistic habits or the materialistic thinking in your own life. Maybe I'm being old-fashioned, a little stop and smell the roses, but have you stopped and smelled the roses recently? Because they smell pretty good. I grew up in Portland, which is the city of roses. And there is a certain time of year, near the end of summer, where it's almost as if you can walk around the city, close your eyes, and just smell roses everywhere. And it's on a day like that that you really just want to sit on a park bench and sit quietly. Rebecca's favorite aroma is creosote during rain. Hey, everybody's going, oh, yeah. Have you stopped and smelled the creosote is maybe what an Arizona audience should consider. Have you stopped and smelled the creosote? I do believe that it is God's intention for us to slow down in life. I do believe it is God's intention for us to appreciate the things around us. When you read Psalm 23, The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. What is the image that you get from that psalm? Is it an image of hustling and bustling, of busyness and business? No, it is the idea of cool waters, of lying down in green pastures. It's the idea of feeling the safety and security that wealth can never give you. Safety and security that only God can provide. And you can lose everything in this life. You can have everything taken away from you. It can be burned to the ground. And you can still lie down in those green pastures beside those cool waters in the shade of a tree created and nurtured by God. And you can be a rich, rich saint. That is what God expects of us. This life is not going to last forever. You might have 70 years, 80, perhaps, if you're strong, maybe a little bit more. And after that, you are going to face judgment. God is not going to ask you if you won an Olympic gold medal. God is not going to care what title you held in your job. He's not going to see a business card. He won't need to see a resume. God is going to ask you, what did you do with your life? I gave you blessings, and they're blessings to be enjoyed. Let's not forget that. But what did you do with those blessings? Did you hoard them to your own destruction, your own hurt? Or did you do exactly as I said? To love God first and foremost, and to love your neighbor as yourself. Do not lay up for yourselves treasures in this earth, but lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven. Share those things with your fellow man, 1 Timothy chapter 6. Be willing to be charitable and hospitable, giving to any who have need. Because at the end of this life, you don't get to take any of it with you. Now, if you're not a Christian here this morning, you really ought to be. This is your opportunity to make a change in life, to put those materialistic things behind you, and to stop blaming your affluence for your indifference to spiritual things. It's not your money's fault. Friend, if you have denied the gospel call, it's your fault. Whatever need you might have, please come forward as we stand and sing.